Tonight on This Is Vinyl Tap, here within my lonely frame, my eyes just hurt my brain. Baby, when you walk, you shake just like a willow tree. This is a mean old world to live in, and I can't face it all by myself.
In 1948, Columbia Records introduced the 33 and a third RPM long player record. 1 year later, RCA Victor introduced the 45 RPM single. Listeners now had a choice, only the hits or the full album. In the last half of the 60s, the best bands realized the potential of the longer format and began to build a cohesive body of music that must be heard unbroken. The arrival of downloadable music has increased the temptation to stay in the shallow end with the hits. This podcast believes every album tells a story. Tonight, we tell one of those stories.
Well, good evening, everybody. Welcome to a new episode, a very special episode, if you will, of This Is Vinyl Tap. I am Tony Slagle, your host for the evening. Unfortunately, for those of you sick of hearing my voice. And I'm joined always tonight by our regular host, Doug Cooper.
Truth.
And our very humble producer, Jonathan J.M. Rowe.
Hello, Tapsters.
So as I mentioned tonight, this is a very special episode. It's not really a true violation podcast as we've done in the past because we're actually going to review
an
album.
It's an emergency
podcast. This is a button line podcast.
Yeah. But the reason why we're doing this LP tonight is because the man behind it, Jeff Beck, passed away just a mere 10 days ago, January 10th, 2023. He was 78 years old. So we are going to talk tonight about his 1968 album, Truth, which was the first album by the first incarnation of the Jeff Beck group. So going to be talking about just him and his legacy and what made him so unique. I'd like to start off with asking the musician of the podcast a question, Jonathan J.M. Rowe.
Okay.
So I've been reading a lot. I will, just for full disclosure, tell everybody who's listening that prior to doing the research on this, fairly shallow in my knowledge of Jeff Beck. I mean, I know songs, but I didn't know a whole lot about him. And I'd never really listened to this album much. But I've been reading a lot about him, and people talk about how unique he is. So mm-hmm. I wanted you to weigh in, and Doug, you can as well, about why he's considered, I mean, he's considered one of the greatest guitarists ever, but why does he stand out as such a unique talent?
He probably did. I've been listening to some podcasts about from guitarists since Jeff Beck passed. And one of the things that I think that makes him very unique is that he didn't stay in his lane. If you listen to Clapton, you know, Clapton, his phrasing, his tone, he never really changed that much. If you listen to Jimmy Page, you can just tell a sloppy riff by Jimmy Page. He never really experimented all that much with what the guitar could do. He just wanted to make the guitar make. He just wanted to write song, use the guitar as a means to come up with riffs. Jeff Beck explored what the guitar could do. He was unique in that he was not attracted to the acoustic guitar immediately. He started getting jazz. He was trained. His mom learned him to be a classical pianist.
Well, didn't his uncle teach him how to play a couple of instruments? I think the upright bass and the violin.
Yeah, I mean,
he went through, started with piano, then went to violin, and then went to cello, and then a couple other things, and then the guitar. Right.
But one of the things, he explored just all the sonic all the sonic things that a guitar could do. So if you listen to him early days with the Yardbirds, and then just starts going into the 80s, 90s, and even into the 2000s, his guitar style changed quite a bit.
You know what's so funny about that?
What?
Is in my research, I came across a clip of a quote from Eric Clapton talking about, Clapton says, you know, I wandered around, but Beck just stayed right where he was. And I'm, what?
What?
So I say, show me your Fusion album.
I want to talk about that briefly because one of the things that strikes me is the reason he did that, not knowing or not sticking his lane, but the opposite of that, because I think we're laughing because Clapton made a dumb comment.
Yeah.
I mean, Clapton did do little jumps, but nothing,
nothing like Beck.
Beck went from a pick to fingers
to having nothing but the whammy bar in his hand, and it looks
and
like
he switched guitars all.
But if you look at his early career, this is a point I want to make. He seems very restless.
Yeah,
like he's a restless guy. He's not comfortable staying in any really one place for very long, and I think that speaks to his experimental nature in the guitar and things he was trying to do.
I'm stealing a quote from somebody I can't recall, but Jeff Beck is a guitar explorer.
Mm, yeah,
he's restless. He wants to see what's over the horizon. He's also a tinker.
Mm-hmm. He did it with cars. Yeah. I mean, you can just kind of tell that
he's got a bunch of cars that he works on, and he's got guitar noises that he works on. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I would want Beck on my album if I had a whole bunch of songs I really like.
Yeah,
because he's not going to support the songs. I think that this is the opposite of what I always say I like in guitar players, which makes it funny. But he's so good at it, it doesn't bother me. The songs are to support Jeff's guitar playing, not the opposite.
Yeah. I think that we're talking about how he explored the guitar. If you look at him at the last 20 years of the way he played guitar, he had the whammy bar constantly in his hand, and he had his fingers. It looked like he's pinching the strings. You ever notice
that? He's doing all kinds of stuff.
But one of the things,
you never hear anybody talk about who are the best slide guitar players. No one ever brings up Beck.
He's amazing. Yeah, I was listening to
it. He's so precise, you can't tell sometimes that it's a slide.
I was listening to Mike Campbell talk about him today of the Heartbreakers. He said, last time he saw him 10 years ago, he said he was doing stuff with the slide guitar that he did not know was possible. And, you know, Mike Campbell's not a bad slide guitar player. But he said there was just stuff that he was doing that and it was obvious that he had rehearsed the crap out of that. He knew because he was making noises that he had absolutely, he could not figure out how he's making those noises.
There's two guys that you would name if you had, who expanded the vocabulary of the guitar the most, electric guitar. I think you would say Hendrix and Beck.
And I think
both of them were stealing from each other.
Yeah. Yeah. I think of all of those guys that came out of the British blues revival, the early 60s or late 60s. Beck was probably the closest to Hendrix and experimentation and coming up with just weird sounds.
Yeah, that's the thing that stands out to me in paying attention to the guitar in a way that I maybe don't normally, just because we're talking about a guitar player tonight.
What, you really don't have a choice on a Beck album. You're going to pay attention to
the sounds are odd. Mm-hmm. And being a non-musician, I even more so don't know how he's doing what he's doing.
So he does use some techniques that you can kind of explain. So one of the things he does, I mentioned, like he's looking like he's pinching the guitars or pinching the strings when he's playing guitar. One of the things that he did was he was a master of harmonics. Harmonics are when you hit with your left hand, if you're a right-handed guitar player, you hit with your left hand a note on a fret. And then you go up 12 bars or a whole octave, and then you just barely pluck a string, barely put your finger, and you put your finger 12.
So you get both tones.
Get both tones. And so it gives you this really harmonic stuff. And what he could do with that whammy bar was he could hit one note and then just use this whammy bar to make, like, he could play the whole melody.
He's got a guitar solo with one note where he's bending and whammying it all over.
Well, I heard, one a really good example of that is his version of Somewhere Over the Rainbow, which is, it's amazing.
That's another characteristic of Beck is he's not a songwriter.
No.
So, you know, you think about Eric Clapton or Jimmy Page, the other Yardbird guys, those both turned into songwriters, significant songwriters. Jeff never went that direction at all. And he was hesitant to sing also.
Which I didn't understand. I didn't think he had a bad voice at all. But
yeah, I think he's like he meets his wife when he's 12 years old and he loses all interest in everything else. Mm-hmm. And his wife is guitar. And he really doesn't have an interest in composition or singing.
I was just laughing at the singing thing, because if you're not going to sing, you might as well get Rod Stewart to sing for you.
Yeah, which, you know, that's exactly what he did. Yeah. One thing about Beck and this album that we're about to listen to, so much of this stuff was taken and used by other people that when we listen to this record tonight, we're not going to be able to hear it the way people heard it when it first came out.
Right.
And that's, I would love if there was some trick where they can get you to hear it for the first time before you've heard everything that's downstream of it, because I know it had to be mind-blowing. I've heard little Steven talk about it and how it just absolutely changed everything for him. A funny story is somebody busted into little Steven's basement and said, "Rod Stewart's white. No way." Everybody said, "No way." I also read somewhere Rod Stewart would hide sometimes so that people couldn't tell he was white.
Well, no, he did that because he had stage fright. He would hide behind the amps.
That's funny to think of Rod Stewart with stage fright.
Well, yeah.
That's what I mean when I say we can't imagine this.
Yeah.
In fact, the New York gig that got them a write-up in the Times that essentially got them their label, Epic, signed with Epic, Rod Stewart started behind the amps singing.
Can't imagine that.
Everybody's wondering why we're talking about Rod Stewart, and we should fill you all in. Rod Stewart is the lead vocalist on the album tonight. The first time anybody in the United States heard Rod Stewart, it was on this record. Of course, he has an amazing voice. It would be great to hear this record without having heard "Do You Think I'm Sexy Already?" But we can never do that.
No, because his vocal performance on this is incredible. Going back to your original question, Tony, I guess of the three guys that came out of England at this time that were known as the guitar gods, it was Jimmy Page, Eric Clapton, and Beck. I mean, those are the ones that were getting probably the most attention. And of the three of those guys, we touched on this earlier, he seems to have the most detached or aloofness to playing as opposed to the rest of those other guys. And I think that it's because he doesn't write the songs. He's not necessarily that indebted to the song itself. What can I bring to this song? While as opposed to Clapton and Page, they wrote the song. They're so integral to that. But there's almost, to me, one of the things that makes Beck so incredible is that aloofness. He's in the service of the song. I know that Doug said earlier it's kind of sounding contradictory, but he adds something to every song that I think that if he had actually written it, that it would have been more difficult.
As a I'll just call myself a newbie or a novice when it comes to Jeff Beck, what I will say about him in comparison to the other two guitarists you mentioned is I think he's significantly more interesting to listen to. Like, significantly more interesting.
What you said is very important. Beck is an intellectual experience. Mm-hmm. I've never caught myself on the edge of tears listening to Beck play a solo. I've never felt like, oh, my heart's been ripped out. But my mind is so engaged. And he's not going to do what you expect. And as soon as you get comfortable with what he's doing, he's going to do something else. Mm-hmm. And I think about Clapton. I think Clapton has some absolutely amazing licks that are heartfelt. I think about what's on Derek and the Dominoes. And some of those are gut-wrenching licks. I think Jimmy Page writes leads that are among the most memorable of anyone.
Yeah.
They're hooks in themselves. I think he writes leads. I don't think he improvises leads. But Beck, I can't tell you a hook he ever wrote. I can't tell you a heart-wrenching lead. But when he's of the three, he's my favorite to watch on YouTube.
Yeah, mine
because
too.
Because I went, what's he doing? What's he going to do next?
The thing you said about, you know, you can't remember the Page writes these things that are memorable or whatever. I just wonder because I haven't watched these YouTube videos or whatever. Does he just change it up every time? I'm guessing that there's a lot of spontaneity to what he's doing
there
with
is.
The song.
I've watched, I don't know how many times I've watched.
He's my favorite. Yeah, literally. He's probably the guitarist I've watched the most.
I like watching him and Stevie the most. And anything I can watch of Hendrix is just not that much of Hendrix.
Right.
But he does change it. And, you know, Page doesn't play leads anymore. Ladies and gentlemen in the audience, if you can tell me why every time Page is on a stage with, like, at a
Foo Fighters or,
Beck's induction,
yeah,
to the Hall of Fame. He just sits there and he will never take a lead anymore. And I don't know what's going on. Beck changes.
Yeah.
He's restless. I mean, that's,
yeah, I think that's, it, that, I think that's obvious. And,
it's, and he just probably has hyperactive, whatever.
I don't know if we want to get into this now, but his, if you look throughout his history, he does change styles quite a bit. I mean, he goes from doing blues, doing folk, doing,
well, well, changes styles bands. Inside
change
the
bands, like
inside
a
song,
a
he changes styles.
That's, yeah, true. That's,
yeah,
true.
Yeah.
And we'll get into this more when we talk about it. But the thing that struck me the most about this album, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, like I wasn't, and I'm not going to repeat myself and say that a million times, but you know, my only point of connection with this was the first Zeppelin album. Because there are moments where
there are
it reminds
moments.
Me of that album.
Yeah.
Yet this came before it. It was released before it. And what this band was doing was they were doing it well before Zeppelin was even a band. And as you were mentioning, Jam, about all these guys kind of hanging out and seeing each other, you cannot convince me that Page, who is a big part of Jeff Beck's life and his... and
yeah,
success,
they grew up together.
That Page wasn't watching what was going on and was heavily influenced, oh, yeah, by what Jeff Beck was doing.
Well, and you have half of Zeppelin on this album.
Yeah, that point.
On a,
yeah,
song or two, yeah.
Yeah.
Not that they don't make up most of it, but I tell you, it's when the people who are additions make their appearance on this album, it's not hard to find them.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
it really isn't.
And we're talking about Keith Moon and John Paul Jones. Who
and Jimmy Page?
On, yeah, well, of course, Jimmy Page is on Bolero, and he's probably chiefly responsible for setting the framework of that song.
But I even heard that who was the drummer, Mike Waller?
Yeah,
that he was mad because he thought that they could have been bigger than Zeppelin. He thought that with Rod Stewart and Ron Wood, that they probably could have been bigger than Zeppelin. And they said they had that hard rock sound that Zeppelin was going
for. You know why
they
weren't?
They couldn't write music.
They couldn't
write
music.
Well, it wasn't just that.
Or Rod Stewart could write music.
It wasn't just that. I'm convinced it was Mickey Most because... you know, Mickey Most was their producer and manager, mm-hmm, and his partner was Peter Grant, and Peter Grant ended up going with Zeppelin, and Peter Grant was the guy who,
yeah,
pushed that band into the stratosphere. Yeah. I'm not saying that their talent didn't help, but that guy, I mean, he's the guy who took over for Most on the Jeff Beck Group and got them the tour in the U.S. that got the Jeff Beck Group going, yeah, through the roof. So I really think that early, because you're right,
that's a good point.
I think really writing point. Songs help prolong that. But I think early on, having Peter Grant in your
camp. Of course, early on, both bands were doing the same thing.
Yeah.
Essentially,
they were,
yeah,
taking, yeah, great American blues players and pretending like they wrote their songs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
So. All right. So we want to talk about Beck's history?
Sure.
Yeah.
He was born during the war.
He was.
1944. He grew up in a borough in South London. I don't know how all this works because you have, is it Sutton? We need all our English fans to,
yeah, tell us exactly
all this
where
stuff.
That is, but yes.
The borough of Sutton in a town of Wallington. I didn't know you could have a town inside a borough, because that doesn't happen in New York, I don't think. But anyway, I guess middle class as you can get and had a good life. And we don't get any of the family drama that we get with some of the other guys.
No, he had a pretty good childhood, and he got along great with his sister.
Yeah, and his sister's also...
very
somebody
important.
Who is important to what, yeah, happens to his, yeah, career for one particular reason.
Well, he hears Les Paul on his radio, and Les Paul's playing How High the Moon. So, ladies and gentlemen, that is an electric guitar. And Jeff Beck digs that sound.
And
his mom said, oh, it's just tricks.
Yeah, that's right.
So that is so profound because the rest of his life is about guitar tricks.
And what is he inspired to do?
Well, he is inspired to build
guitar.
A guitar.
Yeah. Guitar.
Yeah.
He wants to build a solid body.
So his mom wanted him to play piano, and I read he even actually destroyed one of the keys on the piano because he desperately wanted to play guitar. He said, "I'm tired of taking piano lessons. I want to play guitar."
That doesn't surprise me,
yeah,
because I know that there's a song later in his career that he was sort of semi-forced to record, and he purposely recorded it out of tune because he didn't want to, because he hated doing it. So
yeah,
he's a willful person for sure, and that may be another reason he didn't become the Led Zeppelin. I don't know. I don't know if he had the... He doesn't have the character for a band member. He's the opposite of Clapton. Clapton was a solo star who was always trying to find a band. And this guy's a band member who's always trying to get out on his own.
Yep.
So he also heard this guy, Gene Vincent, and the Blue Caps. And they have a guitar player called Cliff Gallup. And that really got his attention.
Yeah. I'm a viral movement on the line. Listen to that now!
And that really gets my attention, too.
Yeah. Sorry for that not to really grab something. Your attention. Yeah.
Some people call him the king of
rockabilly
guitar. Yeah. So no wonder they do.
Yeah,
and you know, and he bumped into Buddy Holly and decided he needed a Stratocaster.
Yeah, he saw him play when he was, I don't recall how old he was.
It's so
15,
unfair.
I think. Saw Buddy Holly play.
I never
play
got to see Buddy Holly.
Jeez.
You know?
That'd be amazing.
I never got to be alive the same time as Buddy
Holly.
Well,
and it inspired him so much that a year later, when he was 16, he joined a band called the Deltones. That was his first band.
That's such an American name.
And they wore pink matching jackets when performing.
Oh god!
So it was one of those bands.
And then eventually he wasn't into the blues, but one of the Rolling Stones piano players
introduced him.
Yeah, introduced him and let him borrow an album called the Folk Festival of the Blues. And he heard Buddy Guy, which was younger than all the other blues guys, was cooler than the other blues guys, was more active. And that really got him interested in the blues.
Yeah.
So he started making bands, putting together bands. Mm-hmm. Tony, do you know any of the names of the bands?
Well, the band, I believe, after the Deltones was a band called Night Shift, which he started in 1963. I recall, and I actually have a tune of theirs called Stormy Monday.
Said they call it Stormy Monday, low Tuesday is just as bad. Wednesday's worse, and old Thursday. Oh, so bad.
So that's a
nice sounding, a nice respectable little white boy singing that song.
and that's in 63.
How old was he?
Teen, I guess. About
44. That. Yeah. 63 minus 44.
Yeah,
he was 19 years old.
Glad we have math people in the show.
And just think about that. That's 63, and that guitar sounds, I mean, it's sort of a standard blues song, but that the guitar sounds different than anything you would think you'd hear from 1963.
Yeah.
You know? I can't believe the recording's so good.
Yeah.
You know, he's also in college at this time. He goes to Wimbledon Art College.
All these British guys go to art college. That must be, sign up for this.
Avoid the draft.
No, sign up here so your parents think you're doing something while you're playing rock and roll.
Well, he's not in college for very long. He's in college for about a year, but it's around the same time.
A common theme on this program.
Also a common theme, but it's around this time his sister keeps telling him he needs to meet this guy. She had gone off to UL Technical College in Epson, and that's where Jimmy Page lived. And she keeps telling Beck that he needs to meet this guy because he's this weird, thin guy who plays a weird-shaped guitar like his. And so they take a bus to go meet Jimmy Page. And he said the first time he met him, he just blew him away. And they become friends, and they start digging into the blues together.
But then you also know Ian Stewart. Didn't he get to, you talked about this earlier, but wasn't he childhood friends with Ian Stewart?
I don't know that.
But I think they were...
That's who gave him the record.
Yeah, that's who
we learned the blues from.
Yeah.
The The song I played, Story Monday, was one of two singles that Night Shift released. The other one was Corrina Corrina, which was interesting because we talked about that when we talked about the Bobby Dylan album. Yeah. And that's a song a lot. I mean,
Bob Wills
yeah. did it.
It's different.
Yeah.
You can't get... Those two songs are very similar, but very different.
Well, and the other thing that happens around this time, somebody who ends up being similar to the Yardbirds, a guitar factory, John Mayall, asks Beck to join his band, and he declines and stays with Night Shift because they've released two singles. He sees that there's some dough in that. John Mayall isn't really much of anything yet.
Yeah.
And then we talked about John Mayall in two separate episodes, the Clapton episode and the Fleetwood Mac episode.
Yeah, and that's going to be kind of a common theme when it comes to Jeff Beck. He's had all kinds of opportunities to join.
Yeah, he
big bands.
Offered an opportunity to join the Rolling Stones and
Led Zeppelin at one point. Oh no, Pink Floyd.
Pink Floyd.
At one point, they would.
Oh, that's right. They wanted him to replace Sid Barrett. I forgot about that.
They found another guy. What's his name?
David Gilmour.
Oh, that's right.
Another amazing guitarist for very similar reasons.
David Gilmour is a huge Jeff Beck fan, by the way.
I can imagine.
Those two may be on opposite sides of a spectrum, even though they respect each other. Just David Gilmour is so precise, and when you hear him, you know he's going to stay with what he started with.
Yeah. And he's not going to stray from that much when he plays live.
No,
it's what he's doing.
I think Beck might have destroyed Pink Floyd.
Maybe.
All that kinetic energy.
Yeah. It depends, because Sid Barrett was also, I mean...
He would have made it a much different deal.
But Sid Barrett was also, I mean, he wrote pop songs, but in terms of guitarists, he was also kind of all over the place. He would do these long, extended experimental jams. So it might have fit for short term, but they wouldn't have been the success they became.
Do you think he would have been a good partner with
Roger Waters?
No. Nobody's a good partner with Roger Waters.
But, you know, we talked about this on our Houses of the Holy episode. You know, around this time, Page is becoming a pretty sought-after session guy. Mm-hmm. And he's also getting Beck session work as well. And one example of this is a band called the Johnny Howard Band. And they record a single called Java and Rinky Dink. The reason we're not going to play it is because there's some speculation as to whether it's Beck or Page on it. I think they both played on those recordings. But they also, the two of them are also in a band, a guy named Screaming Lord Sutch, and the band was Screaming Lord Sutch and the Savages around 1964. And this was a guy who ran for Parliament. I think he holds the record for the number of times he ran for Parliament. I don't remember the name of his party, but it was this goofy party name. And
a very silly party.
Something along those lines.
The silly walk party. So,
yeah. But they did it. They recorded a single called Dracula's Daughter. Beck is obviously playing guitar on that. I'll give you a little sample of what that sounds like.
Lips are blue, eyes are red, I laugh like gurgling water. But I can't resist that passionate kiss, I'm in love with Dracula's daughter.
That's Dracula's Daughter by Screaming Lord Sutch and the Savage. So, anyway, this is also the time, around this time.
It's a deep dive, ladies and gentlemen.
He meets Nicky Hopkins. Do you want to tell people who that is, JM?
Nicky Hopkins. Well, we've encountered him at least once before.
Twice.
We did it with the Kinks. And
the Who.
And the Who, yes, that's right. He played on Who's Next, and he played on Village Green Preservation Society. He is probably most famous for playing with the Rolling Stones, but he is a phenomenal piano player. And he has played on all sorts. He did the piano part on She's a Rainbow.
Which is probably what he's most famous for,
right? Probably his most famous.
Yep. And their best song.
Yeah. Well, it's among their best.
It does stand out among the dreck.
You like it because it doesn't sound like the Rolling Stones.
But he was just phenomenal piano player. He left us a little too soon. He died in the late 80s or early 90s from birth, he had some sort of intestinal problem. He was just phenomenal. He was the most sought after piano player, boogie-woogie style piano player.
And well, they met in 64, a week after Christmas. They're at a studio session where Beck's playing guitar with ex-members of this band called Cyril Davis, R&B All-Stars, and Nicky Hopkins was a part of that band. Jimmy Page is producing this session. and Glenn Johns is the engineer.
Jeez.
And this stuff was like forever tough to find. I think they finally released it on that box set.
Beckology.
Beckology. Yeah, but one of the songs that they recorded for that session is a song called Stealin'.
That sounds like some bottleneck guitar.
Yeah, you can already tell, though, that
he's not satisfied sounding like anybody else.
Yeah. He's already changing his tone and his style, and also has great Nicky Hopkins piano.
You know what's weird is his pitch is perfect, but he doesn't like to stay on it.
Nope. He doesn't.
I guess if you have perfect pitch, you can oscillate a little bit without any worries. Mm-hmm. I've seen him play the bottleneck all the way up between the pickups, and he says, "Up here, you're off by the slightest bit. It messes everything up." Yeah. And he was just so precise.
So, to name a couple of more other bands before we get to the big one, he was in a band called The Crescents for a while, and then finally, before he joins the Yardbirds, he's in a band called The Trident.
They were a pretty big band playing the blues,
and we've got a Trident song to play for you guys right now called "Wandering Man Blues."
Did you hear that resolution in the first?
Yeah.
He doesn't do dun, dun, dun like you're expecting him to. It just.
It's like ghost notes what he's playing. Yeah. Yeah.
So Thelonious Monk or something.
Yeah.
It's no secret I'm not a big fan of the blues for the most part. But I will say the thing that struck me in doing the research for this and listening to this album tonight, or the one we're talking about tonight, is it didn't really matter because it was so fascinating and compelling to listen to him play the guitar.
Yeah.
My wife at one point came in and said, "Do you like this stuff?" And I said, not normally, but I can't not listen to it.
Yeah.
So
you did it to me too, Tony. You got me listening to these prog albums and power pop. I'm listening to that band that sang that song about the girl's mom that's got it going on, and I'm enjoying it. What the?
There you go. As we mentioned, he gets a break and joins the Yardbirds. Want to talk about how that happened? That's a pretty interesting story.
That is a pretty interesting story.
Because they just lost Eric Clapton. They were looking for a
Yardbirds had this guitar player that was good, and his name was Eric Clapton. Eric Clapton likes to play the blues. He does not like to play pop tunes because he's all that about the blues. So the Yardbirds come up with this little tune, Tony.
For Your Love.
I wonder what that sounds like. For your love, I bring you diamond rings and things right to your door. For your love, to thrill you with delight, I'll give you diamonds bright. There'll be things that will excite and make you dream of me. You know, that's not really good singing there, but it's a cool tune sound.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of grumpy looking Eric Clapton pictures taken at this time.
Well, supposedly at the time when they had to do this song, Clapton would just almost walk off stage. There's just so many sullen pictures of him.
It's funny. But this is at the you take yourself too seriously age. I mean, I would have done the same thing, I'm sure, in some alternative universe there's a Doug Cooper with guitar talent, he might have done the same thing.
So they offer Jimmy Page the position first in the Yardbirds, and he declines. Do you know why he declined?
Well, the story I heard is he's making too much as a session
player. They offered him £25 a week, which is about $70 to join, and he was making £80 a week as a session guy. So it's I think I'm okay.
That's a comfortable pop in and leave and sleep in your own bed.
Yeah,
and,
exactly.
Right.
But he did recommend his buddy Jeff Beck for the position.
And story is that the manager for the Yardbirds went to go see Jeff Beck play.
He's playing with the Tridents.
Yeah, playing with the Tridents. Said, "Hey, this guy is really good.
It's surprising. I think that there's a, it would be surprise me that if they didn't know who he was, because Jeff Beck was getting session work and he was playing around. Not only, as you said, he's in this band that, that people know too.
When Jimmy Page, that's cooler though, Jimmy Page. Anyway, he told the manager, and the manager said he hadn't heard him before, so he goes to this
to see the
venue
Tritons.
To watch the Titans. And
Tritons.
Went Tritons,
Tritons.
The Titans. Anyway,
that's a good
too much
too.
Pro yeah. football. There are no Oilers, though, ladies and gentlemen. this guy's blown. I can't remember the name of the manager, and I can't say it even if I did know it because I think it's Italian. But he goes there. He thinks he's great, and he walks up to Jeff Beck and says, "I want you to come and try out for the Yardbirds." And Beck's incensed. He says, in the interview, Jeff Beck goes, "He just walks up to me and he's acting like we didn't just blow this show up. I mean, we blew them out of the water. He doesn't say anything about that." And then he says, "You want to join the Yardbirds?" Like everybody in the whole world wants to join the Yardbirds. And they do, so I did.
Right. I think he was in the band for 20 months.
Yeah, something like that.
But the impact was huge. I think they recorded all of their major hits.
He was probably the most important.
It's the period of the Yardbirds that if anybody talks about the classic time of the Yardbirds, this is the time they're talking about with Beck.
This is where all of them were on. There were other members of the Yardbirds.
Yeah, and they were. This is when they started writing really interesting music. Yeah. They started trying out new things, including something called Psychedelica.
Yeah,
that's right.
You ever heard of that, Tony?
I have heard of psychedelia.
It's the hippies.
Well, and he is, I believe, been when people talk about the Yardbirds, and in particular, a song that they re-recorded for the album we're talking that he re-recorded for the album we're talking about, not Shape of Things. I think they talk about that being the first commercial psychedelic song.
Well, as we have encountered before when talking about this topic. There are about 10 albums of their first psychedelic albums. There are about 10 bands that are the first psychedelic bands. And there's a whole bunch of songs that are the first psychedelic songs. Mm-hmm. But the Yardbirds are credited as one of the songs, mm-hmm. The Shape of Things. And it sounds psychedelic to me.
Shall we play a little of it?
How about that?
I just love all that craziness happening in the background.
Yeah.
That's what I love about this period of music.
I do.
Somebody made a good point that from 64 to 66, everything changed so much that a song recorded in 64, if you held it in a drawer and released it in 66 or 67, it sounded like it was an ancient thing.
Yeah.
And you always hear that change happens faster as time goes by, but I don't think there's another period of time when music changed so quickly as it did during this period of time.
Well,
look at the Beatles, how fast they changed.
And just but even technology, the amplifiers became bigger, drum sets. Just look at what happened to drum sets.
And effects.
In effect, they started figuring.
People figured out reverb was an instrument.
Yeah, and feedback was something cool to do. And distortion wasn't necessarily a bad thing.
The funny thing about the Yardbirds, though, and in particular Jimmy Page, is he ends up swallowing his pride a year after Jeff Beck joins the band, and he joins the Yardbirds to replace he actually is a bassist. He joins.
Yeah, he joins as a bassist.
That's an interesting story.
Not a lot of recordings with Jimmy Page on bass either. I think there's some live recordings, but
right, and then
the bass player. Quits. And he's an important part, even though he's a bass player. He's a very important part of the band, so he quits. And
the podcast I was listening to going, you know what, if you're a guitar player, you can fake it on bass, is it?
Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, J.M. Rowe is the most bass playing. That's your number one instrument, isn't it, J.M.?
That's my number one instrument, yes.
They want to bring Page in on bass, uh-huh. and the manager says, no, And the manager has used him for session work with other bands quite a bit. And he goes, no, he'll take over and he'll push Beck out and he'll be on guitar. And Beck's one of the strongest advocates
to get Jimmy Page
to get Page there because they're buddies from way back.
And what happened?
Oh, Page takes over and does it.
Well, and you can listen to our lovely Houses of the Holy episode to find out what the little bit of history about Page being in the Yardbirds and what happens after that if you want to.
But yeah, he did. But there's stories that Beck was used to being the lead guitar player and he would just watch Page start take live on stage. He would just watch Page.
Well, Page is playing bass and then figures out a way to get someone else to play. Who'd replace him?
It was the guy who was originally the rhythm guitar, that Chris Drea guy.
And they moved him to bass and Page goes, I'll play guitar.
Yeah.
And then for a little while you had Page and Beck.
Dual guitar attack.
On guitar, which from the interviews I heard was either wretched or
fantastic.
Amazing. But it did sell out shows when people thought they were going to see two of the greatest guitar players.
My guess is it was probably about 50% of the time a mess.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think Jimmy Page is the sloppiest lead guitar player in history, and Beck is pretty precise. And
I think Beck is now. I think back then he probably was a little looser.
The other thing that happens at this time is while Beck's in the Yardbirds, and this probably happened because of what was happening within the band and Page playing guitar, he decides to go record some stuff as a solo artist, and he records a song we're going to be talking about later. Beck's Bolero was recorded at this time, and it was the B-side to a single called Hi-Ho Silver Lining, which is great because this is when Mickey Most was trying to make Beck into a pop star.
Well,
We should tell how Beck left. He got really sick on an American tour. This was a stupid, stupid, stupid tour. It was Dick Clark's 36th day.
Bandstand
type thing. Yeah, they'd get on this bus and they would travel and do one or two shows every night. And they were playing with all these little bubblegum pop bands that they had nothing in common with. So they'd show up and start playing. Everybody's saying, turn down the guitar. And Beck left after the second show. And he got really sick.
Yeah.
And
he's had a history of having illnesses at the wrong time.
Yeah, he had a
car wreck. And
anyway, he he went to California with his girlfriend. That was it. Yeah. So they talk about he got kicked out. But
there's also
if you leave the tour,
he said at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame induction for them that he got fired. But later on he said that. And I actually heard this in an interview. He said that he wanted to leave the Yardbirds because he didn't like the direction it was going, felt like he was kind of getting pushed out, and he wanted to be with his girlfriend.
Yeah.
Well, the direction he ends up going is Mickey Most, who is the manager for, we've talked about
Animals.
It a couple of times tonight. He was manager for also manager at this time for the Yardbirds. He wants to make Beck a pop star. And so he gets this song, Hi-Ho Silver Lining, who Beck sings lead on.
Yeah.
And
it was released like three days earlier by
it's an English band called The Attack. Their version failed to chart. Beck's recording, which was released a couple of days after their version, hit the top 20 in the singles chart in the UK, and it was his biggest solo hit.
Stayed on the charts for a long time.
Yeah, it didn't crack the Hot 100 in the US, but on this is Beck singing lead, John Paul Jones is playing bass, Clem Catini is on drums, and Rod Stewart sings backing vocals.
I didn't know about Rod Stewart.
Let's see if you can speculation that maybe he didn't, but
no, he did. The reason he's not credited is he was under contract with someone else. But let's see if you can pick him out.
And getting fat, saying everything is good.
I love that song. I'm sorry.
I love that song. I absolutely love that song. Yeah, it's a great song.
That's a little bit more into Tony's area.
No, it's a great song. It's
there's nothing wrong with it.
No, but you can hear Rod Stewart on it.
Somebody said something about Jeff Beck singing. Jeff Beck did not aspire to be a singer.
Which I don't understand, because he did a pretty...
Yeah, he did a fine job. I've heard other things where he sings, and he's just fine. Yeah. And you think about... All these guys don't start out the way they end up. I mean, singing something they develop just like their guitar playing.
Right.
Yeah. But somebody said something I thought really was sharp on an interview I saw. If Beck had been 15 years later in the punk deal, that was a perfect voice for a punk band, even if he didn't play guitar.
Yeah, I guess I listened to the same thing. I heard the same thing.
I do want to, though, return to something, because it's an interesting
story.
And you
can hear Rod, by the way.
You can.
At the end.
Something you mentioned about the sitar story, because I think that was interesting, before we completely move away from the Yardbirds.
Oh, you're talking about the Heart Full of Soul.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They had a sitar on there. I guess everybody in England was...
messing with the sitar.
Who was the first to have a sitar? Wasn't it the Kinks?
I would say it was the Beatles, wasn't it? Norwegian.
Was that deal the Kinks did?
I think you might be right. It might have been the Kinks.
That was months before
Norwegian
Wood. Yeah. Huh, yeah. It was on, we covered that when we did Village Green.
Go back and listen to Village Green.
Great. I feel like listening to that album right now. anyway, so the Yardbirds are doing Heart Full of Soul. And a sitar player comes in and records a little deal for them. And it turns out he's not in tune. So Beck says, I can do it. I can do it. And so he runs off. And I think he goes to where Jimmy Page is and gets this fuzz box effect. And they fiddle with the treble and they put the fuzz box in. And he does this lick from the sitar. And he makes it sound like a sitar on the guitar. Ladies and gentlemen, that's cool, in case you didn't know.
Well, then, yeah. And yeah, that was just the experimentation that was going on. That's a quintessential 60s.
It's garage rock, yeah. Just steeped in that sort of whole minor chord sounding. It's great. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah, and it's got those haunting backing vocals with the echo on it and all that. Yeah.
It's hard to beat that kind of stuff.
I love that stuff. That's why I'm stuck in this time period. I know.
So I think it's... probably, since we did mention Rod Stewart, probably time to move on to him getting his band together.
Well, there's one other thing that might be interesting for people out there.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
There's a film from a famous director. I can't remember. I think he's Italian also. It's called Blow Up.
Oh, yeah. He also did Zabriskie Point, I believe.
Anyway, he's real artsy. So yeah. If you're artsy like us, you'll probably love it.
This is a family podcast.
The Last Tango in Paris. Mm-hmm. Is that one of his?
Mm-hmm. Are you sure about that?
Well, we're going to research that. Yeah. Anyway, they want to do something about the London social scene.
That was all about swinging London.
Yeah. So they want the Who and the the manager for Yardbirds says, yeah, you just go tell the Who that you need complete director control, and they go tell them that, and they go, no way, mate. So he manages to get the Yardbirds into this film called Blow Up.
Yeah.
It's one of the only videos that you can find of Jimmy Page and
Jeff
playing together. Yeah.
Really? They're on the stage together in that?
That's right. And they're playing in front of all these Londoners who are completely...
And everything's red. Dead. It's just like bizarre.
But the audience is completely stoned. Well, no, they're not stoned, but they're just... When I say stoned, I mean they look like they're made of stone because they have no expression. And I'm sure it's some artsy thing I don't understand. But so you might check out some scenes from Blow Up.
It is, guy. Just to circle back around, Michelangelo Antoniani is his name.
See, I would never have tried to say that name.
Yeah. He did do.
I don't see it on the list here, but he did do Zabriskie Point, which was a sort of a blow-up version of Southern California.
Oh. One thing that we neglected to mention that is probably the best line that we'll say tonight. After doing Hi-Ho Silver Liner, Beck said that that song was like a pink toilet seat around his neck for the rest of his life.
I heard that, yeah.
I think it's a great song.
It's a fine, fine song.
You've lost your chance to tell him how good
it was.
But
he is famous for disparaging everything that he's done before, like whatever he's doing. He does not have a lot of good recording.
So going back to something that you mentioned earlier, JM, about sort of incestuous all this blues, British blues guys were and how they all kept in touch with each other. That's essentially what Beck is doing in 67 when he's looking for the band. He's going to see people and, you know, trying to figure things out. And he ends up bumping into Rod Stewart in the back of a bar called
and Rod's with a band called Long John Baltry.
Oh, is that who he's with?
And also with Steam Packet. And what's his nickname? Rod the Mod.
Oh yeah, Rod the Mod.
All right, so yeah, you mentioned who'd you mention?
Long John Baldry.
Yeah, that's, we talked about him in the Elton John episode because Elton John sang lead for him as well. So Rod Stewart and Elton John were both in that band.
Such a small world.
But the funny story about Beck asking Rod Stewart to be in the band, he said he's looking for a singer and he asked him if he wanted a job. And Rod Stewart thought he was drunk and said, "Yeah, but I don't believe you. Ring me up tomorrow." And Jeff's like, Jeff Beck thought he was a snob, but he ended up calling him anyway the next day. And so that's how they hooked up.
I'm glad he called him.
Yeah. And then the next thing he was looking for was a bassist, and he finds another guitarist to play bass.
One of my favorite guys in all of these things. He seems like such a happy guy on the sideline.
I love Ron Wood. I wish he was in a different band, but I do love the guy.
I think he's wasted in the Stones. I wish Rod Stewart had not become a superstar and they could have stuck together because they were so good together.
They were great together.
His
really
guitar sounded like Rod Stewart's voice.
Yeah, it reminded me of Bowie. Sounded like
and they had the same barber.
They did. It reminded me of Bowie and Mick Ronson, the way the two of them, and Ian Hunter and Mick Ronson as well. So.
Yeah.
Ronson's another one who stole quite a bit from Beck on some of these deals for his Bowie album. Anyway.
So then they're looking for a drummer, which is a little bit more complicated.
It's a little bit like Spinal Tap.
So they tried out Ray Cook, the drummer from the Tridents. They tried out Viv Prince, who was from the Pretty Things. This guy named Rod Combies. I don't know if that's how you pronounce it. He would later join the Straubs. But he was...
Well, it was a funny story. They're not practicing or anything. And they go and play this gig at the Historia, which became the Rainbow Theater.
Yeah.
And it is, everyone who saw that show comments on how absolutely horrible the show was.
Well, that was with this Rod Combs guy who ends up with the Straubs. That's who the drummer was at the time.
Beck goes, "I agree," and he fires the drummer, but then nobody was practicing.
Yeah, and then he picks up Ainsley Dunbar, who was with the John Mayall group.
Who went on to have a fantastic career. Well,
talking about Eric Clapton and the blues, evidently Dunbar didn't like what the Jeff Beck group was playing, and he also hated their hippie clothing style. So one night after playing the Seville Theater, he just quit and never came back. So they end up getting another ex-John Mayall drummer, Mickey Waller, and the band that we kind of think of as a Jeff Beck group is complete, or at least the initial Jeff Beck group is complete.
Initial version.
And that brings us to tonight's record.
Yeah, so they play live several gigs, and then they get the ability to go into Abbey Road Studios. In May 14th of 1968, they start recording this album. Beck's 24 at the time. The story I heard was that Mickey Most, who likely got the band into the studio, was not thinking anything commercial was going to come out of it because he'd heard him play live. He's like, this is just going to be whatever, but I'd like to get him to get in the studio. So he gets him in the studio. Columbia Records, who I'm guessing were at the time the label that was interested in them, or maybe they were signed to them or something, they were also confused. According to Jeff Beck, he said they would come in the session, they would look around and they would say, "Who's that guy on guitar?" even though they knew who Jeff Beck was, they were just confused about all the goings on, what's going on. But here's the kind of interesting thing about this, though. They were the first independent sessions allowed in Abbey Roads
that weren't tied to a label.
Yeah. Wow. So, and Mickey Most, because of the whole commercial thing, lack of commercial thing, he's not around much. You know,
he's the producer.
Yeah. And so
that's probably very good.
Well, according to the engineer, the person who comes in to kind of take over stuff is Peter Grant.
Oh, really?
Peter Grant starts pushing things going forward. Yeah, Most comes back in for the mixing, but Peter Grant, evidently, according to the engineer on the album, was there, the person who was kind of managing things. Wow. And so they're talking about a release date. Columbia doesn't want to, they're really reluctant to release this album. They don't see any potential in it. And again, Peter Grant says, let's get these guys to the U.S., which is kind of an unheard of thing, right? Mm-hmm. So they go to the States, and it paid off big time. American audiences love this band. They go gaga over them. And we talked earlier about that show at the Fillmore East, where the Times does a review of it, of the show, just talks about how great they were. We want to talk about weird pairings. They played with the Grateful Dead that night.
They both cover the same song, one of those songs.
They do.
Is on this album.
That's absolutely true. So Peter Grant gets that review and sends it to Epic Records, and they respond with an offer. Here's an interesting thing, talking about how Beck is so, you know, how I said I believe, and we all sort of agreed, he's restless. He was on Epic longer than any other artist in that label's repertoire.
Really?
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Had no idea.
When did Epic start?
I don't know.
That's a good question. That's a subsidiary of...
With the name like Epic, it seems like a long time ago.
It does. But because American audiences loved them so much, they end up pushing the release date. So it's released earlier in the States than it is in the UK. It's released in July in the States and not until October in the UK and in Europe. And it hits number 15 in the US charts. Doesn't even chart it. So it's one of those weird things where we talk a lot of times about how British audiences get something that the US audiences do. This is one of the times when the US audiences get something that the British audience.
Yeah, it's just so crazy.
Before we get into the tracks, is there sort of a general description that you could say that this album is? If you're going to use terms to kind of talk about the mood.
Disconnected.
The thing I was going to say was going to be longer. It was like nothing else that was going on at the time, but had some elements of stuff that was going on at the time. I mean,
this is the opposite of a concept album.
Yeah. But it's hard for me to believe that Rod Stewart and Ron Wood joined the Face, because it seems they could have gotten a very different direction with this.
I think they were players and the direction is Beck's. That's pretty clear.
But I think Beck...
And the fact that it's disjointed...
Yeah, it's very disjointed.
Makes perfect sense that it's Beck's record.
But it does have, I think if you can sort of pinpoint that, I would call it almost proto-metal.
Yeah,
well, I mean, a lot of people call it the beginning of heavy metal.
I could see
And where, a lot of people call it the beginning of prog.
Yeah, and I can see where...
I don't see prog, but I definitely see metal in it.
I could see where Black Sabbath got some idea. Yeah,
you can see what, Jam?
I could see where... Some of Black Sabbath got some of their ideas from.
Yeah, I mean, it's a surprise to me, because I always draw that straight line to Zeppelin, not having known much about this album, but it's so obvious that the bands I grew up listening to that I loved listened to this band.
Yeah,
Zeppelin listened to this.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt, Zeppelin listened to this.
So you got these, we'll let people hear it.
Yeah. So, all right, should we go ahead and dig into the album?
Yeah, I really want to hear it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the very first song on side one is a re-recording of a Yardbirds tune called The Shape of Things.
I wish this was the whole. I wish the whole album was more like this song.
I do too.
Because this is something so unusual and so powerful,
and it's firing on all cylinders. And
Rod Stewart's voice is
amazing.
Everybody's doing their part so even well.
The bass work is incredible. Well,
the drums.
Oh, the drums are out of this world.
It,
yeah.
It was Rod Stewart's idea to do this. To despise, will time make man more wise? Here, within my lonely brain, my eyes just hurt. Yeah, a bit different.
I don't know who could hear the new song out of that one.
I don't know either. Yeah. I forgot to mention, though, just, and I want to mention this, that song that we just heard, that Yardbirds version, solo, the guitar solo that McCartney plays in Taxman was influenced by the guitar solo.
I read that too, and I don't think I can hear it.
Well,
I need to listen.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, you're right. They're so completely different, and he definitely made it slower and muddier and dirtier and eviler sounding.
And he plays steel guitar on this.
Yeah,
song.
The Showbud steel is what he got.
Nice.
And a lot of people say this is where heavy metal.
Well, it's heavy.
Climbed out of the ground.
It's heavy and sludgy, that's for sure. There's no doubt about it.
So interesting to me.
Yeah. I mean, the guitars are just, the solo isn't necessarily blistering. It basically just rehashes what Stewart's singing, but it is.
They do that a lot.
Again, going back to, and this is, I apologize for anybody, this is going to be a little bit of probably drum I'm going to beat when we're talking about this album is the Zeppelin stuff. That's exactly what Zeppelin was doing too. The whole interplay between Plant's voice and Page's guitar.
Yeah.
And again, you can't tell me that wasn't influenced by. I've got a different viewpoint of that early Zeppelin stuff after listening to this album.
It's a little less out of nowhere.
There's parts of it where it sounds like Hendrix.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Hendrix heard this too.
Yeah.
So this came out just a little bit before Electric Ladyland.
Okay. We're ready to get to song two on side one. Song two, side one, Let Me Love You. My absolute favorite song on this album.
Is that right?
I love that song.
I love
it. So bluesy.
I love it so much, though.
Ladies and gentlemen, did y'all hear that?
It's pretty Zeppelin.
It's the most Zeppelin-y song on it.
But you know who else? Again, Hendrix.
Who's everybody's copying is Buddy Guy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is Buddy Guy's influence. And if it sounds like Zeppelin, that's because he's two bands are copying the same American blues artist.
Rod Stewart's vocals are fantastic this.
Oh, and my God. What he could do.
And when you say that Beck never wrote riffs or whatever, he's got that little riff at the end of each line he punctuates.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I think is great.
No, they're great riffs. I'm just saying those aren't the ones that
pay the bills.
Gonna say he also sings on that.
Yeah.
Jeff Beck sings on that first time you hear the baby when you walk, you shake just like a willow tree. That's Jeff Beck singing that first part of that.
Yeah.
How do you perform like this as a vocalist and then say, you know what?
Let's do
I wanna do Do You Think I'm Sexy?
Yeah, I don't know.
I have no idea. His vocals are amazing.
Well, and one of my favorite bits about the song is at the end where there's like an exhale, Rod Stewart exhales, and then he just almost sighs the word crazy at the end of it. It's so great. It's just like the perfect punctuation to this song.
A tool with that voice.
Yeah, and this is something I'm going to interject here a little bit. Jeff Beck knows good music.
He surrounds himself with people.
He does. He has a great job and letting them go. He's letting Rod Stewart go. He's letting Ron Wood go. He's letting Mickey Waller go. And he trusts them.
Yeah.
You know, and that's one of the things that he does very, very well.
It's tough not to see. I mean, this is, it's obviously Jeff Beck's album and his guitar is crazy, but man, Rod Stewart.
This could almost be a Rod Stewart album.
Rod Stewart is really adding a whole lot to this, what's going on here. Yeah. And it's funny because I never really thought about him singing that kind of plant style, yelpy, high-pitched yelpy vocals, and he's great at it.
Yeah,
you know?
He's really good. I mean, this is, I think this album is his best vocal performance overall.
And I really wish I could have heard this album. There's parts of it that require sincerity.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's hard to think about.
It's hard to think of this playboy up there being sincere about Old Man River or whatever. But if I'd been 18 when this came out, and I'd never heard any Rod Stewart before, I would be able to enjoy
run to the room and go, "Oh my God, Rod Stewart's walking."
Compare this, and then you know, then you got the Faces where they got a bar on stage.
Well, yeah, and the Faces is perfect for Rod Stewart.
Yeah, it is.
And he doesn't have to be sincere with the Faces. No, he just has to be drunk.
Yeah, which he was once. All right, so. We're ready to go on.
Oh, yeah.
Moving on. Speaking of the Grateful Dead, moving on to song number three, Morning Dew.
Please walk me out in the morning dew sometime. Can't walk you out in no morning dew. I'm sorry. I walk you out in no morning dew.
The song cuts, that clip cuts off right before it just gets incredibly interesting.
Yeah. I love this song.
This is my favorite song on the album.
Is it? It's close to my, if it wasn't for the crazy shape of things, this would be my favorite.
I love that, like I said, that bit right before we cut off where it's just like that cacophony of sound is so great.
And all these new noises, I can't imagine. You know, people are going, what is he doing?
Yeah, and it's got the buried bagpipes that are all through.
You know what this song's about?
You know who plays those bagpipes?
Who does?
Nobody knows.
Some lost bloke on the bagpipes.
Do you know what this song's about?
Nuclear war.
Yeah. I read the lyrics. I'm like, really?
Yeah.
And the reason I brought the Grateful Dead up is this was a song that they
covered all the time. Yeah.
I love Nicky Hopkins' piano on this. It is just, it's a great headphone song because you got the guitars with that wah-wah.
It's doing
on
some bizarre stuff.
It is such good stuff. Yeah. This is a Bonnie Dodson song.
She's a Canadian,
one of our dear Canadians. such a huge portion of Canada listens to us. She's probably listening tonight.
Hello, Bonnie.
We'd like to tell you how wonderful your song is. This is based on a Tim Rose version of this song.
Really?
Apparently, this song was covered by a whole bunch of people.
But this is definitely...
And it's no question why.
It's a fantastic song. It's definitely the trippiest song on the album.
I think it is, and Rod Stewart does a great job.
His voice is just amazing on this.
This is just like, what about this? What about this? It's like an undisciplined person who's really hungry going through the grocery store just grabbing, I like that, I like that. And then they have this whole basket full of things that make no sense. Yeah. And then they go home and make a meal that blows your mind.
Alrighty, moving on to song number four, a song I know but knew before, but not because of this.
The AC/DC song.
AC/DC. A song called You Shook Me.
You shook me up.
So we have a little competition between a piano and an organ going on here.
And the organist is...
Who's the organist, Tony?
Is it John Paul Jones?
It is John Paul Jones.
Yeah. Which, okay, so let's talk about this for a minute. Jimmy Page swears he never knew that the Jeff Beck Group recorded this song.
Really?
So John Paul Jones is on several songs on this album.
He just doesn't talk during the session, and
Led Zeppelin did a version.
It's on their debut album.
Yeah,
and
this is an old AC/DC song that they. I'm sorry, it's Muddy Waters song.
Muddy Waters that Willie Dixon wrote. But here's the interesting thing about this. So Rod Stewart swears in interviews that Robert Plant and Jimmy Page used to go see them play live, and they played the song live all the time. John Paul Jones is on this album. For Page to sit there with a straight face, of course, it's not like he has a reputation of ripping other people off or anything.
But, and what's it, 5 lawsuits they were in?
No, it's crazy. But for him to, and then the other thing is, I read a story where he played this for Jeff Beck, the Zeppelin version, and said, I want you to listen to this drummer we have. Listen to this. And was like taunting Jeff Beck about their version of You Shook Me. It's just, he just sounds like a real jerk.
Yeah.
Well, the show I saw with the manager that was managing both of these, he had nothing nice to say about Page.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Well, I will say this about the both songs. So the Zeppelin version is twice as long. It's nowhere near as interesting musically.
No.
All the interesting stuff happens in the bridge. There's an organ solo, a guitar solo. Mm-hmm. The only thing I would give them an up on this, and you're probably going to throw me out of the vinegar and saloon when I say that, is I think Plant's vocals are better than Rod Stewart's on the Zeppelin version. But everything else is,
I think that's
fantastic.
A matter of taste.
I think it is a matter of taste. I don't really,
I think they're
like
both
it.
Great vocalists.
They are, and I'm not knocking Rod Stewart's vocals on this, but I like
how Stewart's vocals are a little more subdued.
See, I love how Robert Plant's over the top and just full of this.
But another thing that I like about this is Nicky Hopkins is first and foremost.
No, he is.
And I love how he, and Beck, another headphone song, listen to what's going on both ears, what Jeff Beck is doing. And then he'll come in, he'll be doing something completely different. And then it's like somebody's waking up going, oh, yeah, we got to do this thing together at the same time. Okay.
Well, I'll tell you something about my friend Tony.
Uh-oh. What's that?
He has to break things into competing camps.
I do. I hate to say it. But
they both can be really good.
But
I'll tell you who else does a great job with this. Is Muddy Waters.
Oh, yeah, no. Muddy Waters is great. But, no, the reason I'm bringing it up is it was a surprise to me.
Yeah.
And it was a surprise to me that I musically preferred this version to the Zeppelin version because I love that first Zeppelin album, which is also a kind of an odd thing because it's so bluesy. But I needed to publicly shame Jimmy Page.
Last thing I'll say about this, if you want to know what a Les Paul sounds like, very good example of what a Les Paul sounds like. It's got that muffled, I can't really, high treble but muffled sort of sound.
This is 1959
Les Paul. Yeah.
Look at that. So, don't touch it.
Are we going to mention that?
We have to. Ladies and gentlemen, if you're wondering what T is talking about, it's the striking resemblance between Jeff Beck and
Nigel Tufnel from Spinal Tap,
which is the most funny movie. That's the only movie I rented it from Blockbusters and watched it and then hit rewind and watched it again immediately.
We're named after it as
Are
well.
We? So. Yeah. Anyway, for all those who think we stole our name, we were on Zoom and we were talking about what our name should be. And then someone said Spinal Tap.
It was you.
No, I thought you said Spinal Tap, and I said, did you say Vinyl Tap?
Oh, that's right. That is it. You said Vinyl Tap, and I was,
and
oh,
then,
man.
Found out that 758,000 other people have thought of the name.
But
oh, well.
I contend we're still
thank you, Bachner.
Second best. Anyway, all right. So
we're about to change scenery.
Yep. Moving on to the final song on side one, Old Man River.
That old man river, he don't say nothing, but he must know something. That old man river, he just keeps rolling along.
That's some good bass playing.
Guess who plays it?
Jeff Beck, ladies and gentlemen.
Jeff Beck plays it, that's right.
He doesn't play guitar until like 2.5 minutes into the song.
He doesn't. Well, there's a little bit of like little kind of points, but the guitar doesn't kick in until much later. And John Paul Jones is playing the organ again.
Yeah.
And Keith Moon
is playing the timpani.
The timpani. Yeah.
And we don't need the timpani.
I like the timpani.
I can't stand it. It's so
I can see. I would like to hear it without it.
It's they're doing it right because this isn't a this isn't an anthem. This is a man talking about the frustrations of his life, and it's a small man. He's not an important man. He's not a pharaoh, and he's sitting there talking about that. And Rod Stewart's doing a great job of being his voice. And then we got this hyperactive teenager banging around on these huge drums.
I actually thought he was kind of restrained on this compared to some of this other stuff. But
maybe they put him far apart or something. He had to run. But it sounds like it's about to go into this choir that's going to take over, and then the symphony's going to jump in. And no, it's just...
Well, it's from that... Yeah, I've never seen Showboat. I don't know.
Are you an American?
I don't know if I love this song as much as you do.
I love the song, and I love about 5,000 versions of it. And I like this song version, too. But I want those kettle drums out of it.
I want to say this. It's and maybe it's one of these things that I just need to... I mean, I don't dislike the song, but it's the lyrics seem a little strange coming out of Rod Stewart's mouth.
That's because of what I just said. If you didn't know Rod Stewart...
Yeah.
And you heard him singing, you'd be singing.
I agree with you. I think this is one of Stewart's...
This is where the Playboy Rod Stewart doesn't work.
I have this in my notes. If Stewart had kept in this vein and not done Do You Think I'm Sexy, and then... But he started doing... Like, when he started doing the Great American Songbook later in his life, it doesn't work.
You're probably right about that.
And you'd be saying, stop the kettle
drums. I don't feel like it's a complete miss. It's like...
I don't think it's a miss at all.
I think it's about a half of it.
I love the way it starts off.
I was real hard on myself because I was thinking, Rod, this isn't what you're supposed to do. This is... But I was only saying that because I knew the future.
That's a valid point, and I should probably reconsider it, because I just have this image of him singing "He Don't Pick Taters," and it just is
I have that problem a lot with all these British guys doing these blues tunes. And I have a problem with authenticity with a lot of them. When Jagger's up there doing his hoochie coochie dance and he's and he's trying to be Muddy Waters, and I'm going, that doesn't work.
Yeah.
So I've always had trouble with it.
But this is one of his, of the songs that he's done from the Great American Songbook, I think this is his best performance.
Yeah, well, and there's, other than the kettle drums, there's no one in there messing up the arrangement.
I love how it starts off with just the Jeff Beck playing bass and the organ, John Paul Jones just took
I love that.
Yeah, I love how that starts
off. I want the no kettle drum.
Well, it gives you that, like, it's a misty morning on the Mississippi, and here's this guy coming out looking over the railing, and...
I get it. I get it. It's just not one of my favorite tunes on the album.
Well, what you don't want to do is shake hands with Rod Stewart after he sings this and feel there's absolutely no calluses on his hands at all.
All right. We ready to move on to side two?
Let's do her.
Side two, song one, Green Sleeves.
I don't know about the placement.
I don't know why he did it. I think it could have been like the last song.
I know why he did it. It was the last. It was the last song they recorded.
Somebody heard him doing it and said, that's good.
No, it was the last song he recorded. He's admittedly says he's not very good at the acoustic guitar. And he says, if you listen to this, you can tell.
Well, he's not. Yeah, it's not stellar, but it's still heartfelt.
They were trying to figure out what to record next, and so he opted for this. I agree with you. Talked about
what I heard is somebody, a producer, walked through and heard him just fooling around with that and really liked it and asked him to put it down.
I will say this, because we haven't talked about this in a while when you talked about the placement. So it's been a while since we've talked about the sequencing of an album, and you're right. This is an odd thing
to put on side.
This is the hit first position. Song
on side two. Especially after what the first side we heard, and even sort of phasing out with Old Man River, it's weird to flip the album over and hear this particular.
I think this would be fine as the last song.
And I do too.
It fades out, and
but who knew he could play acoustic?
I want to talk about the acoustic guitar deal. I'm going to name some famous British guitar players, and I want you to tell me something they did on the acoustic guitar.
Okay.
Right. Jimmy Page?
Stairway to Heaven.
Okay. Every kid in a guitar store in the whole country.
Over the Hills and Far Away.
Well, that too. That's an easy one. Pete Townsend?
Pinball Wizard.
You got the beginning of Pinball Wizard. You got a bunch of things like that. Keith Richards?
Wild Horses.
Wild Horses. Oh, you got 100 things with Keith Richards. Eric Clapton?
Tears in Heaven.
His biggest hit of all, Tears in Heaven. Oh, George Harrison?
Here Comes the Sun.
Yeah, and while My Guitar. Oh, no, that's Eric Clapton plays that.
But my point is, Jeff Beck is the most estranged guitar player from the acoustic guitar that I can think of.
I don't think he's ever credited on acoustic guitar besides this.
This is such a weird thing that this pops in here because I've never seen a picture of him with an acoustic guitar.
I haven't either.
I kind of feel like it's taking up valuable real estate, to be honest with you.
Well, I appreciate that there's some nuances to what he's doing.
Yeah.
But he's way outside of his.
Well, but the thing I like about it is it's a remarkably recorded. Whoever the engineer was, he did a remarkable job recording this because it is so clear. It does sound like a Deutsche Grammophon classical recording.
Except when we talk about great guitar players, we never talk about classical guitar players and what they do. Uh-huh. And there's a real good reason for that. I don't think any rock and roll guitar players want to
sound like I don't think Yngwie Malmsteen.
I don't think they want to say, "Hey, who's better?" I don't think they want that conversation to start up.
Yeah, Segovia or Jeff Beck. Yeah.
All right, moving along to song two on side two, "Rock My Plimsoll."
Rock me all night long.
Is this song about a mom rocking their child to sleep?
This is about a person who wants to be an invertebrate.
How do they become an invertebrate, Doug?
By getting their selves rocked all night long.
This is probably my least favorite song on the album, but another headphone album because his guitar work on this. He's like three guitar players, and he sounds like three different guitars.
Yeah, the only thing interesting about this song, I think, is the guitar playing.
Well, it was recorded before this album. This was recorded back in his solo period, and Ansley Dunbar is the drummer on this song. Hmm. And I agree with you. It's a little too straightforward bluesy for me.
Yeah.
But the guitar work just makes it compelling to listen to.
Yeah.
And it was the B-side of Tallyman, which was a earlier hit. And it's a ripoff of B.B. King, Rock Me Baby. There's another comparison with Led Zeppelin.
All right.
Here's the big one.
Moving on to song three on side two, Beck's Bolero.
Another B-side. This is the unlikely B-side of
Silver Lining.
Yeah, which it's this. I think this is the first Beck song I ever heard, and the most frequent Beck song I've ever heard.
It's the one he opens his shows with, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, well, this was the song we talked about during the Zeppelin podcast, or was it the Zeppelin podcast or one of these? Maybe it was It might have been. Yeah, I think it was because this was that super group that recorded this. This was Jeff Beck, Jimmy Page, Keith Moon, John Paul Jones, and Nicky Hopkins. And I think during those sessions where Keith Moon, when they were talking about getting together, he said, "Oh, that's good. This would go over like a lead balloon." And that's where the name Zeppelin came from. But yeah, this is another song that was recorded.
You know, I used to not like, and I grew to really like it having to listen to it. I've seen him do it live, and I like it when he's done it live, but whenever I've heard it on the radio and stuff, it's just never done that much for me, so maybe live enough. His guitar playing is remarkable on it. It's so weird that he did not write it, which I think there is some controversy about.
Yeah,
that.
I'm not sure if I really want to believe Jimmy Page when he says that he wrote it, but...
I think he structured it. I mean, he's copying Bolero.
Yeah, Page said that he arranged.
Yeah, who wrote the classical?
Oh, face. Don't ask right now.
Damn it.
Yeah, every time I hear the classical piece, I think about
10.
Yeah, that's so bad. Yeah.
No, I think every person or every male our age thinks about 10 when they hear Bolero.
And Bo Derek.
But there was. So Page said that he arranged it, he played on it, produced it and wrote it.
Well, he played that 12 string, right?
Right. And that the only thing that Jeff Beck was doing was the slide bit. Everything else is him. Jeff Beck says that's BS, that he and Page were hanging out in Page's front room and Page had a 12 string guitar and he starts playing that. It's Ravel.
Ravel.
Yeah. Starts playing the Ravel Bolero rhythm. And then Beck said it sounded so full and fat and heavy that started playing a melody over it. And then he went back home and worked it all up. So I don't know. Again, do you believe Jeff Beck or do you believe a guy who's been sued 5 times for ripping people off?
Well, the funny thing is that they played this together when he was put into the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
And they're great buddies still. So I don't know how you have a disagreement like that and not get mad at the other guy. But
they said they had a falling out in the early 70s. And then after John Bonham died, became buddies again.
It had to have been tough for Jeff Beck to watch what was going on with Zeppelin and the unbelievable success that band had, considering that they basically started from the same point. Mm-hmm. And I think it was interesting because I was thinking back on Jimmy Page's involvement with Beck early on, and Jeff Beck, while Jimmy Page was a good session guy, Jeff Beck was having all the commercial success earlier than Jimmy Page was, and then they flipped.
Yep.
It just had to have been difficult.
And then he had to watch Rod Stewart just take off.
Well, a lot of those people talking about Beck said that he shot away. He never was. It wasn't like he was trying for that. I mean.
Yeah. Well, you're right. There are periods of kind of inactivity with him, right?
He's not active, and then he's putting out stuff that is obviously not commercial.
Right. Yeah.
It's good music, but it's not commercial.
It's not good.
The original Bolero and this one are both heavy and plodding and are not emotionally interesting to me whatsoever, but I'm always intrigued to watch, and I watch it on YouTube just to see the guitar stuff.
Yeah.
That is interesting.
Yeah. All right. Moving on to song number 4 on side 2. That is Blues Deluxe.
People, but I sure think I've got it bad. I don't know too much about love, people.
Did I hear some crowd noise?
I think it is a live tune. I don't know if they...
No. It is not a live tune.
It's not. They just piped it
in. That's as real as rock and roll band out of Boston.
Do you know where the crowd noise came from?
Monty Python, where they have the view of the theater.
It's the crowd noise from a Beatles concert at the Empire Hall in Wembley.
They did. And Elton John did that on Benny and the Jets. Yeah. So, it's not... But it's seven... Should have been it should have been live.
Well, Beck said he wanted something with he wanted to stretch out make it a roomy noise.
Right.
I don't think it works.
I'm glad that I know, because I didn't think it worked as a live.
That's an odd choice.
This song is just
it's a little plotting.
Well, there's nothing new here.
Right. Yeah.
And I don't think it's... I would like to see something else make its way in there.
Well, the thing... there is one thing I will say about
maybe
it.
Maybe an acoustic version of What Child Is This?
My wife did walk in the room and go, "Why are you listening to Christmas music?" I said, "It's not Christmas music." That's hilarious.
I do think everybody shines pretty good on it.
I mean, they've stirred up the water, and we're all expecting something. Okay, what are you going to do now?
Yeah, it's Beck's and Bolero, and then all of a sudden,
it's just a straight ahead blues deal.
Well, they sort of redeemed themselves.
Yeah.
You know, so that's good. But so we'll move on to the last song on the album. I Ain't Superstition, another Willie Dixon.
But the Lord ain't got me so far, and I won't let it stop me now. The dogs begin to bark all over my neighborhood, and that ain't all. Dogs begin to bark all over my neighborhood.
See, I wouldn't want to play guitar with him.
No.
Because
no.
I'm going to go, oh, yeah, I got an idea. And then he's going to come up with this noise.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go, I'm going to throw my guitar
What's
down.
What's going on there?
This is an amazing
song. What is that
oh, he's
sound?
He's got a wah-wah
he's
and something
a,
else.
He's doing a wah-wah, maybe through like a Leslie cab. I cannot figure out what he's doing. But it is so, so interesting.
I've never heard that from even from him again.
I know.
No, this
just,
is...
But just listen to it. Another. It's another headphone song. It just floats from ear to ear. I have absolutely... I can't tell if he's... They're doing something where...
Did we
he,
say what the... You said the name.
Yeah. I Ain't Superstitious. Willie Dixon.
Do you
yeah.
know somebody wrote a song for Beck later on in life called Soup?
Oh, yeah. That would be, I believe, Stevie Wonder, right? Yeah.
I don't know what the connection is, but he wrote that song for Beck, which is... Really weird.
It is.
It's a great song.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But if, ladies and gentlemen, if you know the connection between Beck and Stevie Wonder and Superstition, please write in.
This is a great way to end this album.
It is. And it shows off everybody.
Yeah. And it, like I said, it's got a redemptive quality after the kind of song that preceded it. It's so much fun to listen to.
It is.
And it confuses the hell out of me because I don't know what's going on, you know?
This album is very humbling.
Yeah.
This guy's 24?
24.
You know how many more years than Beck I've been playing guitar? Like, a whole lifetime more. More than a whole lifetime. Anyway.
Well, you didn't see Buddy Holly play live, so...
It would all have been different.
It changed your trajectory.
Anybody wants to have an argument about nurture and nature, I offer up two people, Doug Cooper and Jeff Beck. That's the nature argument.
That's funny.
But so, yeah, anyway... It's
a great way to end the album.
It is. And this is, I don't know the nice way to say this. This album was on our original list of eventual albums.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Jeff pushed it to the front of the line. I'm sorry that he pushed it to the front of the line the way he did, but I am really glad we got into it. And he died a little more than a week ago.
Ten days ago.
Of
bacterial meningitis. Yeah.
And he was 78 years old. But, you know, we've had other people die, and we don't...
Normally.
There's what we've done three times.
This is our third.
Yeah. Jerry Jeff Walker.
Billy Joe Schaefer,
who we have to do because we're in Texas.
Right,
but
yeah.
Beck's not a Texan, but he's just such a huge... He's too big of a...
He's a guitar player,
and I love guitar albums.
And he's been a big influence on so many people that play guitar that we've talked about.
I bet he has been on the cover of Guitar Player magazine more than any other guitar player.
Yeah,
he is. You'll hear 100 times he's a guitar player's guitar player.
And you know, I didn't really come to him. I took guitar lesson twice in college. Am I trying to learn? So I said I don't want to be a jazz guitar player, but I would like to just be a little bit more sophisticated in my guitar play. And my guitar teacher said, go get Blow by Blow by...
That's fun.
By Jeff Beck. That's where you want to go. And sure enough, that album hit me.
Did it blow you away?
It blew me away.
It's a fun... is it fusion? Would you call it fusion?
I don't know what you would call
it. It's sure speedy and joyful and playful.
Well, there's just so many different moods on it, too. Yeah. But it's got that same...
So different than this tonight.
Yeah, it is. It's very different.
I've taken guitar lessons twice in my life, too. And the second time was with this guy sitting right next to me.
I didn't tell you to go listen to Blow by Blow.
JM attempted to teach me how to play guitar, and I'm sure it was painful.
No, it wasn't painful.
It was me and Fred, right?
Yeah, you and Fred.
Anyway.
It was fine. I had a good time.
Maybe you should learn to do Love is Blue.
That's a song he recorded out of tune. Yep. That's hilarious.
Dun, da, dun. That's so so many strange songs he covered.
Well, there's, I think that kind of, I mean, like what happened afterwards with him was he was kind of sporadic. He would just disappear for a while and he would show up and he would do collaborations and there were, I mean, he was.
Do you work on your own car? Yeah. If you work on your own car.
Yeah, he became very famous for, guess what he was famous for refurbishing?
Fords.
Fords.
Ford hot rods.
Yeah, Ford hot rods.
I tell you, it's interesting. If you watch him do an interview with somebody about his guitar playing or his music, he's kind of surly and standoffish. And, yeah, well, I don't know, mate. What you want? But I watched him with the hot rod guy doing an interview on hot rods. Completely different. He's so excited to talk about it. He's so happy.
That's hilarious.
He takes him to his garage where he's got a 63 Corvette and a whole bunch of Ford early model. What do they call those? They're hot rods, but I don't know I guess they're just called
muscle
hot
cars.
They're pre-muscle cars.
Yeah.
Like the ones you see in American Graffiti or something, where they sometimes leave the hood off the engine and the fenders off the front tires. But he is just all about
it. They said he could take apart an engine and put it back together.
Which is what he does with music.
Yeah.
It's what he did with Shape of Things.
Yeah.
It's too bad he's gone. And the guy, even though he looked older, it looks like he lost nothing. He doesn't move any less fluidly than he did when he was young. It's really strange when you compare him to his contemporaries. I know he dyes his hair and that helps, but he seemed like he had zero degradation. I remember seeing Doc Watson right before he died, and I could see his speed slowing down and his accuracy slowing down. Yeah. You see Willie Nelson now, he can't play the leads he used to, but Beck, I saw something he was doing months before he died, and it was as good as anything he ever done. I don't know what he did to maintain
his dexterity.
Well,
and so a little bit about what happened after this album, and they kept trying to put him into a pop direction and kept trying to make him be more mainstream, and he just did not care. And he got all sorts of offers to join tours and to join bands. And he would always turn them down. But the thing, he was using this word, he was restless. He always wanted to try something different. He made albums with different vocalists, which another thing, like he was a fine vocalist, but he just wanted to concentrate on playing guitar and did not, he eschewed playing large venue, the thing he did not ever want to do. I think he did a shows at Madison Square Garden and maybe at the Coliseum in Los Angeles. But most of the shows that he really wanted to do were intimate shows. And he just wanted to play with really, really good musicians. And the guys that he played with, Frank Zappa's band, Terry Bozzio, who used to play with Frank Zappa.
And Missing Persons.
Bobby Tench, who used to play vocalist for his band, but also played fine guitar with Van Morrison. Jan Hammer, who used to play with the Mahavishnu Orchestra, fantastic keyboardist and drummer. And just, he sought out these amazing guys to play with. And
what's that album he did with the Vanilla Fudge guys? Is that any good?
There's good parts of it. It's, what was it? Bogart, Capete.
Yeah. Beck, Bogart, and Apice.
Yeah. There's some good stuff on that.
Well, who was he playing with at the very end?
Johnny Depp. Have you heard that album?
No, is it good?
It is surprisingly good. I spent a lot of time just...
What does Johnny Depp do?
He's a pretty good singer.
He plays guitar and he plays bass and he plays
drum. Johnny Depp's also really good friends with Shane McGowan.
Is that right? Yeah.
Well, but I'm surprised at how good that album is. And that I think he did his guitar work for that.
Those two just clicked somehow. Huh. Johnny Depp was with him right before he died. So I don't know very much about Johnny Depp except that he was a pirate and he he was
Edward Scissorhands.
I didn't know that. I know that his wife he and his wife had a problem.
That's like saying a hurricane's a small breeze.
But he was also famous for committing to play shows and then not playing them.
Oh, really? He didn't show up to shows?
Well, he would like sign up to play, be an opening act for somebody and then come out and play with them during the, and he would just say, no, I'll do four, like he'll sign up for 30 shows and do four. And he, so he's kind of mercurial. And he's also, like we mentioned this earlier, he just would disparage everything that he'd done before. Like Hi-Ho Silver Lining, he thinks that's a terrible song.
He disowned it.
He disowned
it. That's a shame because it's such a great song.
Well, I'm glad we had an opportunity to talk about him. I wish we could have done it faster than 10 days, but here it, this is Vinyl Tap. Our speed is not, we're not famous.
We travel at the speed of vinyl.
33 and a third.
That's right. Oh, yeah, sorry. So this is the time in the podcast where we provide our rating for the album we reviewed. And just to remind everybody, we do two ratings. We do a rating that is based on our own personal preference, whether we'll listen to the album again, and then another one that sort of takes that out of the picture and just talks about what we think in terms of the artistry and the critical response to the album. So I'm going to go to Doug.
This is hard. I think that I would give it, as far as how much I like it, I think I would go 4.7. As far as a critical rating, I think I would go 4.9. And that's just this is breaking so much ground and doing so many remarkable things. You have a bunch of great musicians. One of the most original guitar players, one of the most important voices. So it's a big deal. This album is a big deal. The people who were paying close attention to rock and roll when it came out were all blown away by it. I can't share that experience. But this is one of those, it's like a bumper in a pinball machine. It sends the ball in a direction. It's setting the direction of the ball, and it set the direction for rock and roll in so many ways.
All right. Thanks, Doug. JM, what say you?
I'm going to give my critics rating first. I can totally see why this album blew so many critics away here. I mean, the execution of the songs in general is flawless. I'm not saying that the songs themselves are necessarily worth redoing or covering, but every song is just done very, very well. And it's got life. The songs have life. The guitar solos are amazing. So as a critic, I'm going to give it a 4.5. My personal rating, this is hard for me because this is not my go-to album for Jeff Beck. I have tried listening to the Jeff Beck pre-1975, and it, compared to Blow by Blow, Blow by Blow, it is just almost a flawless album. And if we were going to do a Jeff Beck album, that's the one I would have done. Jeff Beck is known for his instrumentals, and I don't like a lot of instrumental guitar, but Blow by Blow to me is just one of the best guitar instrumental albums ever. And it's difficult for me to separate myself from, I love Rod Stewart, love Ron Wood, I love John Paul Jones, love Jimmy Page, I love everybody that's playing on this. So my personal rating is going to be a 3 because I will listen to this again, but I know I'm going to skip stuff. I'm not going to skip anything. So that's my rating.
Okay. Thanks, Jam. I will do mine. Okay. I'm going to give my critical rating first. I'm going to give it a 4.5. I wasn't familiar with this album, but I can see what this album wrought. While I can't go back and listen to it anew, I can sense how unusual it had to have been at the time and how different it was from anything else coming out there, say for something that came out 3 months later. But even the guitar work on this album is, to me, significantly more interesting than that Zeppelin debut. But it's so instrumental in the bands I listened to growing up that I wasn't aware of. So critically, I think this is a 4.5, solid 4.5. I agree with JM, though. It's an album that I'm probably not going to go back to that often. I am fascinated by it. There are songs on it that I really, really, really like, and I'll listen to those. But as I mentioned about a couple of songs that I just felt kind of were a little underwhelming to me, I think, did I give a rating yet for that? Mm-mm. I think a 3.8. I will say, though, in doing the research, I actually got to listen to Roger the Engineer, the Yardbirds album, and that album I love.
That's a great
album. I will go back and listen to that one over and over and over again. So for that reason, I'm very, very happy to listen. And I'll say something we say a lot on this podcast, that my personal rating of this album will likely go up when I do listen to it more often. Because I found myself, I told Doug this when we first started, I couldn't decide how I felt about this album. There'd be times when I listened to it and I was like, oh my God, this is the greatest thing I've ever heard. And then other times I listened to it, I was like, this is annoying me a little bit. So I was just really kind of vacillating between the two. Anyway, that's me.
All right.
So, Jam, I understand you have a recommendation for this evening.
I do. We're talking about, you know, obviously, this podcast is about Jeff Beck. There is a fantastic video out there, and it's been turned into an album, but I highly recommend the DVD version of it. If you just want to see Beck's brilliance, his ability to find amazing musicians to back him up, and his being in his element, he loves the smaller stages. There is a DVD called Beck Live at Ronnie Scott, and it is remarkable. And he has a band, a crack band, and he's got people that come up and sing with him. Mujin Heap, I think, is one of the people that sing with him. She does a really great song. He's got a 15-year-old, she's an Australian bassist named Tal Vickenfield.
Are you sure it's not Dal?
She's amazing. She doesn't even, everybody's just blown away by her, but she is so humble. She has absolutely, like, everybody cannot believe how she's poised on stage, but whenever she takes a bass solo or something, everybody's awing over her, and she's so surprised and so awed by it that, anyway, she's gone on to a pretty good jazz career right now, but it's fantastic. So that brings us to the end of an emergency podcast of This Is Vinyl Tap, where all the podcasts go to 11. You can look us up on Facebook on our group page, and you can send us an email, oldschool@tappingvinyl@gmail.com. But of course, for the ultimate This Is Vinyl Tap experience, please visit our webpage, tappingvinyl.com. You can find past episodes, stuff related to past episodes, and you can always leave us a review up there and let us know what you think of past podcasts. And you can also contact us, let us know an album that you would like for us to look at in the future. For our host, Doug Cooper, our co-host, Tony Slagle, and me, your humble producer, Jonathan J.M. Rowe, this is Vinyl Tap, where all the podcasts go to 11. And remember, that old man River, you just keep rolling along.